and welcome to the Ashley Webster Experience. Thanks for listening in this week. Of course, we do it every 2 weeks, but I'll say this week alongside Brian Solomon and our special guest today, Elizabeth McDonald. We call her Lizzie, we call her EMAC. We also call her really smart. She, of course, is the host of the Evening Edit on Fox Business Network at 6 p.m. Monday through Friday. But she's done oh so much more, and we'll get into that. But Lizzie, welcome, and thanks for being here.
Oh, I love being with you, Ash. You're great.
Well, it's the Ashley Webster Experience, and you've been a big part of my experience at Fox Business Network. We spent many a year sitting next to each other on the Varney Show.
And laughing.
And laughing and making funny asides. And we were like the two old guys in the Muppet Show in the balcony, right?
You're Waldorf, right?
I'll be Waldorf, yeah.
We're the entertainment hub of Varney.
We right? are indeed.
Yeah. The
but
peanut
now
gallery.
You've got on to bigger and better things.
Well, I don't know about
that. I'd say peanut gallery. Anyway, Lizzie, thanks so much for being here. You've got such a great story. I was talking to Brian, and I said, you know, Lizzie is like one of the original New York fans. Families. You grew up on Long Island.
Yeah.
You have a family of firefighters. Mm-hmm. What was it like growing up in Long Island? And for someone like me who, you know, obviously grew up somewhere else, I'm always fascinated about being out on Long Island. How often did you come into the city? Was that a big trip
as
a kid?
We did come into the city. It's a beach community. It's Nassau County. It's Rockville Center. Mm. It's 45 minutes outside of New York City, but we'd also go right to the beach. That's how we lived our lives. And, you know, it was fun. It was a big family. You know, I have seven brothers and sisters who I love very much. My mother never knew her father because he was hit with mustard gas in World War
One. Oh, my.
But she was raised by the chief. And I always thought, who's the chief? And we're always talking about fires and history. So my great-grandfather, as you thankfully, gratefully pointed out, he did run the New York City Fire Department at the turn of the 20th century. His name is Thomas Dougherty. I have often given out a medal in his name. They give out 100 medals at
the
Fire Department annual medal ceremony. Anyway, so let me back up. He worked on the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire, the Sherry Netherlander fire, the General Slocum, which was the 9/11 of its day.
Right.
Major fires. He worked to change fire laws and labor laws. He wrote for the Saturday Evening Post. He brought into the United States a staircase vault because he always said the fire escape will kill you. He was dean of the fire college.
Wow.
And I just recently found out that my sister told me that, you know, he was best friends with the Roebling family, which built the Brooklyn Bridge. And he worked with Daniel Burnham and did the Flatiron. So I always said to Regina, I thought Roebling was a brand.
My sister,
I said, Roebling, is that a brand? She said, no, it's a dishes. It's like the gifts that they gave for weddings and birthdays. And I said, she's going to get mad. I said, can I have some of that? She said, no. So there was a lot of history there. And we're unsentimental. When you're raised in a fireman family, it's a way of life. You're not supposed to really talk about it at all.
It's
what are you going to do? That's what we always say to each other. Oh, what are you going to do?
And right? You mentioned 9/11, and I'm sure that affected your family very much as well.
Yeah, yeah, it did. You know, my sister married a fireman 2 days before 9/11, and a bunch of those guys are gone, including his my brother-in-law's brother-in-law, Chuck Mendez, who was dug out that New Year's Eve when nine firemen, you know, the velocity and the power of the 9/11 pushed the lobby down about three stories. So it took a long time to dig it out. So you can imagine in the dark and the dust, they started seeing blinking lights. And when a fireman is down, it will set off a blinking light so you can find them in the darkness. So they found nine bodies, and then one of them was Chuck. So gratefully, that was a wonderful thing to have that closure.
Well, listen, the fascinating thing about me with you, EMAC, is that you're such a brain box. Now, did this come out at an early age? I mean, were you like a whiz kid in the classroom?
I wonder. You know, I always wonder. I am geeky, but and you're absolutely right. I'm like totally geeky and nerdy. I think I don't know. I had spinal meningism when I was five, so I like to go way up in my head. And I read a lot of books, a lot of books when I was in the hospital and afterward. And, you know, I didn't do very well as a kid, you know, with my health. So I just like to read a lot. So that's what I was doing.
And you also like to write a lot. You've worked for what? You've worked for the Journal, the Wall Street Journal. You've worked for Forbes. I mean, these are very, very well-respected publications. And then you make the transition to television. How was that?
I know. That's a great point. So, You know, I always thought I had a face for radio. I would joke. No. But anyway, I know.
That's what Ashley says about me.
Not true.
So I covered the IRS starting in the 80s when no one else was covering the IRS. I thought, you know what? I'm just going to make my rookie greenhorn amateur mistakes as a reporter covering a beat no one wanted. Mm. And it was the IRS. And I ended up doing a lot of coverage and testified twice for Congress about IRS reform because it was only me and I think one other reporter who quit. And didn't cover them. So, you know, I've broken a lot of stories about the IRS. I wrote a lot. And, you know, I was on Forbes and Fox. And then, you know, I was called in by Fox News to do that and then to do Fox Business.
And
I didn't expect to get the job. I didn't even hand in my resume, frankly.
Was it daunting for you? You spent so much time doing that, you know, in-depth reporting. And then in television, it's the complete opposite. Everything has to be done within seconds.
Exactly.
You know, a two-minute interview is a really long time.
And Ash, you probably noticed it too. It makes you a better writer. It makes you with clarity, and it makes you funnel it down and think more clearly and get right to the subject. And you don't – no tangents, which are irritating. No prevarications, no parentheticals. Just hit it and hit it hard.
Well, you said to a friend of mine – once, but I don't know if you remember this, that was in college. You said, if you have interest in going to television, write for the web, write for print, because that will make you a better on-air personality.
Yeah, and you know, I always say not everybody can be an engineer or a teacher or, you know, but a lot of people try to be journalists. And so I've been through a lot of different editors starting in the 80s. And, you know, it was sort of a hazing. I had Jim Michaels, who broke the news about Gandhi's assassination when he was working for United Press International. He was the editor-in-chief of Forbes magazine. And it was withering. You wanted to be edited by him, but he was lacerating.
But then you,
he would say, go clean that fish, or that's a real room emptier. You know, stories.
Wow.
And so you guys, boy, that made you sit up and, you know. And then at Money magazine, they put out an errors report every month with your name and the error and broadcast it through the whole company and through the the journalism side.
Yeah.
Wall Street Journal, if you had a number of errors, you're going to be fired. If you had two or three errors, you're gone. You had to fact check your own stories.
Ouch.
So it was a hazing, and Ash has been through it too, and you know, you've seen it. But, you know, when you hold on to somebody we love to work with, an editor, whomever, or a producer, you hold on to them tight.
You do.
Right?
You're right. And, you know, I learned writing for radio, which I think is the greatest thing in the world because it has to be very concise, clear, colorful, conversational, all of the C's. But you also have to describe something for someone who's listening. You have to paint the picture with words. And I always thought, you know, well, obviously with television, you have the video to help do that. But, you know, it's not easy. I always remember in college taking a big story and then whittle it down to a 15 second piece of copy. It's difficult to do.
It's like the, you know, the term is, you know, put a beer keg into a perfume bottle. But then you have to make it fun and vivid.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, and Ash and I are, Ash is a genius at that. But I'd like, you know, to say, I don't know if it's irritating, but I, you know, if for example, if Elizabeth Warren is going to go down to Wall Street today, it'd be like jumping into a pool of live hair dryers, or getting her to love capitalism is like trying to teach a cat to bark. You know what I mean? So trying to make it, you're right, Ashley. You got to paint the picture with words.
You have to illustrate it.
You do. And I find it carries over into my normal life outside of the studio. If I'm talking to someone who's a little long-winded, I have this horrible habit of get to the point, to the point.
But you love
rap.
Zip it. Which is what we're really saying.
We have a hard out right now.
Exactly. Can you shut that pie hole right now?
We live in a weird world, let's put it that way. Talking of weird worlds, I wanted to get your take on the political atmosphere in this country. It's so divisive. It's so angry. It's so violent at times that if you have one opinion, other people will try and shout you down and prevent you from even thinking that. People have lost friends. Families are split. You know, people say, well, we had this, in 68 with the Nixon administration and Vietnam and so on. But I really, for me personally, I've been in the country more than 30 years now. I have never seen anything like this.
Yeah, and it's a great point you make because, you know, when you back up and you look broad zoom, what's been going on in this country? And I think it really started in the 80s with the appointment of special counsels. Mm-hmm. When we started to go to the special counsel era, you see the control of Congress whipsaw rapidly between control of the different parties. Mm. So before that, you'd have the Democrats running Congress for years and years and years, or Republicans. And then starting in the 80s to now, it would rocket back and forth. It would gyrate back and forth. And then when you throw in the mix Twitter, you know, social media, it's combustible. And
right.
It becomes a tinderbox.
It's changed everything, has it
yeah.
not?
And so, yes, it has. And I worry about the loss of local journalism. I worry about the loss of local newspapers who are not just the checks and balances on their local governments, but different points of view. And they are. And what's happening is you don't see the moderates. I'm worrying that because of the polarization, because of the loss of local newspapers, that you're not seeing the moderates in the Republican Party. You're not seeing certainly the moderates in the Democrat Party.
You're absolutely right. And the a compromise is a dirty word.
Yeah.
It just doesn't exist. You're either right or you're wrong.
Right.
There's no gray shade.
And I have to say it is Facebook who has yeah. helped demolish local newspapers, right? Because they've
sure.
taken a lot of that content, did not pay for the overhead to pay
yep.
for that journalism. And so,
and
yeah.
they got all the ad revenue
yeah.
for it as well.
And
yeah.
they want to increase their news division.
Yeah.
But I don't know how they do that. You
right.
know, I don't know how they try to create their own news division while not taking away from the individual's voice.
And I don't believe them ever when they say, oh, it's the algorithm.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah.
Who writes the algorithm, right?
People
right.
do,
right.
right?
Well, and, you know, politicians now, I mean, we have a president who uses social media very effectively, uses Twitter. And we've said this since the day one. He goes over the heads of the mainstream media and just talks to his base directly.
Yeah.
And we've never seen anything like that.
We've never seen anything like that. And that's why, despite all the problems, you know, the fact that his base so loves him is just for that, Ashley. You're right. It's his clarity, and he speaks right to the people. He's speaking with them, not at them. We saw that when you and I covered President Barack Obama. He was always talking at people,
yeah.
not with them.
He'd give lectures.
Lectures.
You know,
it was
10-minute
like,
answers.
Yeah, we were in his academic study hall with him. For 8 years. And it was irritating. And it was tiring. And the people knew it. And he, you know, it felt like they were lectured at and talked down to. The president, when he talks with you, you know, I know that he makes a lot of mistakes. I know he makes a lot of errors. I know the issues with him and the problems and the controversies, certainly over Ukraine. But he has a powerful connection with people.
And that's interesting because do you have pushback in your own personal life, family and friends, where they say, how can you, you know, we work for Fox Business, but you just put Fox in there and people immediately say you're, a crazed conservative right winger who believes that Donald Trump can't do anything wrong. And that's not true. We call it as we see it.
Yeah.
But does that affect your life outside?
Well, the way I see it is when that guy hear that, I'll say, is this your parents' Democrat Party? It's not even, you know, I mean, it's really gone over the edge. I mean, we're old New Yorkers, you know what I mean? We've seen, you know, governments come and go, and we've never seen Democrats so vociferously against what made America great.
Yeah, and it's interesting, and we bring this up too, but it's no coincidence, is it not, that you have L.A., San Francisco, New York, these are areas with very high taxes. Where social programs are supposed to be funded on a greater level because that's the role of the Democrat governments in place. And yet these are the cities that people are trying to get away from in droves.
Right. And then what happens is you have, because they lost, you have the Democrats, you know, blaming things like the Electoral College, which makes me crazy because the founding fathers' electrifying vision for the country was basically minority states, right, should have a say too. And that's what underpins the U.S. civil rights system, right? And that's the genius of the founding fathers. And for the Democrats not to see that and to try to push for a mobocracy where you have L.A. or New York and the big tax and regulation, you know, crowds running what the elections should be, it's patently and breathtakingly absurd.
I think, though, that the Democrats that have been elected on the smaller scale, the non-general elections in between the coasts, like we saw in Kentucky, right?
Mm-hmm.
This Democrat won on issues that people cared about on a local level. If he ran on these big socialist ideas that we're seeing on the presidential race,
Warren and Sanders,
or even what's happening in New York with Cuomo and De Blasio, or in San Francisco, he would have got massacred. I don't think this guy would have won.
And you know what bothers me is Elizabeth Warren sort of, how does she not have a plan for how much her plans are going to cost?
Yeah.
It's sort of like this, well, whatever hand wave, like, oh, I'll get to it.
Mm-hmm.
You got to read my plan after, you know, you got to pass it before you see what's in it.
Did
kind
you
of
see
attitude.
The SNL sketch?
Yes,
it was
fabulous.
It's just pretend.
Oh, it's just pretend. And,
yeah.
you know, Really? Let me back up. Because I cover the IRS for a long, long time, for years and years, you have a big government. You need a big tax collector to pay for it.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, I talked to the IRS officials. I've sat down with them. I went into their workspaces. I've driven in cars with them, hung out at parties with them. They do not like to be pulled. They don't like being pulled into politics. Mm-hmm. They're not some denatured, aclinical thing like a sewing machine that'll get the revenue for you. They're populated by human beings that have to carry out the laws that they the neurotic fiddling of the tax code of Democrats like Elizabeth Warren makes IRS officials berserk.
And let me get your opinion on this impeachment process. I mean, are the Democrats gaining ground, or is there something there?
Well,
what's your take on this?
Well, they haven't really made the sale with the American people. And now they're going to try with the public hearings coming next week. What laws did he break? Federal election laws. I keep watching the polls and what the American people are feeling about it. We've always said in an election year, it's August, right before the election,
right,
when people sit up and take notice. I think this Thanksgiving, people are going to start way earlier to take up.
And can I also just say this about the impeachment?
Yeah.
You know, with the publicity fight that this really is, but you always have, the fight in the courtroom or in these hearings and then outside, right?
Yeah.
If you have a big smoking gun, you don't wait to show it.
Right.
You want to put it out in front and show everyone, hey, look, we got him and we're going to prove it. So if they haven't, whatever they have.
So if you haven't seen it now, you're never going to see it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
All right. Yes. And I wanted to, while we have EMAC here, and this is fascinating because it's taken you to Europe and everything else, but I want to talk to you about your book.
Oh, yeah.
And the reason – well, first of all, give me the title of the book.
It's Skirting Heresy, The Life and Times of Marjorie Kemp.
All right. So to people listening, who is Marjorie Kemp?
So Marjorie Kemp is the first autobiographer in the English language. She lived during what's thought to be England's darkest and most violent period. It's Catholic England before Joan of Arc.
1960s.
Yeah, right. When you were born.
When I was born, yes.
It's Catholic England before Joan of Arc was executed. So this is the dawn of the Protestant Reformation.
Uh-huh.
These are the unsung heroes who reformed Catholicism a century before Martin Luther and Henry VIII.
How did you come up with this?
Well, I was, again, in my geekiness, I was just reading a lot, and I read Julian of Norwich, who I love, who's an English mystic, and across her doorstep comes Marjorie. And I was like, who's Marjorie? So I started studying the period, studying Marjorie. I've been studying her for about 20, 25 years. And I thought, well, there's a book in here. Yeah. I never knew about these English men and women who were basically burned alive for opposing Henry IV and Henry V and the Catholic Church at that time. These are the people whose common sense rings like a bell. They are the ones who reformed Catholicism.
Well,
and they're the unsung heroes. So I feel like they deserve their due.
And you gave it to them. And you touched a nerve because a group in England actually took your book and made a play out of it.
Yes,
and you
they did.
Went to England. Yeah. This was last year, was it not?
Yes, it was.
And how did that go?
It was wonderful. So it was performed in the church that the first martyr of the Protestant Reformation, the first person burned alive, William Sawtrey, he's a Catholic priest. He was Marjorie's parish priest. It was in St. Margaret's in King's Lynn, which was back at that time called Bishop's Lynn. And, Bishop's Lynn was burned in a fire, of course. I love that story. I love talking about that. But that happened in 1420. So it went well. It was a packed church. One of the Knights of the Garter showed up. It's a complicated story.
What was it like to make it's a complicated story, but you were fascinated by this story. You write a book, and next thing you know, you're in England watching people perform what your book was about. That must have been a really fabulous feeling.
I walked back to the hotel, and I thought, that was really pretty cool to have them say the line. So, things like – and again, the quintessential exquisite logic of the English people just rings through. So what was happening at that time, the Catholic Church was saying, if you say that Jesus is not the Eucharistic bread, if you say he is not the bread, you will be burned alive.
Ugh.
So that's what was happening. And so the English people were saying, well, Jesus also said he's a cup of wine. I'd like to worship a cup of wine. They're saying, I see more of the image of my my wife in the Eucharistic bread than Jesus. You know, then they were saying, because Marjorie was always crying for Jesus, they were saying, Marjorie, why are you crying so much? Even his own mother never cried as much as you are. We should have left you in the bottom, in the middle of the harbor of a bottomless boat. And, you know, Marjorie was annoying. She was an irritating character. She was a businesswoman, and she would fight with the statue if she could. But, you know, I thought the whole thing was really entertaining and funny. It's Geoffrey Chaucer's period as
Geoffrey,
well.
Oh, fabulous.
Who I love.
And very quickly, you're also going to be heading back over there, this time to Wales.
That's right. I've got to go to Wales.
Proud
in
home
January.
Of my father. In January in Wales, so make sure you've got, you know, lots of waterproof clothing. That's all I'm going to tell you.
Right, for a medieval conference. With 100 academics. So.
That's so cool.
Oh, my God, in Swansea, right? Swansea University?
Right. Light a candle for me, pray for me. How am I going to do with that?
You
yes, Swansea University.
I hope the people who are listening just get a sense of Elizabeth MacDonald. She's everything. She's fascinating, has such a rich life outside of the studio, and yet here she is. She has a terrific show.
Thank you, Ashley.
That's
nice.
A fabulous partner and colleague for me on Varney. Please come back as often as you can. And thank you so much for being here.
Love being here. Great to see you, Ashley.
All right. Thank you, everybody, too, for joining us. We'll see you back here next time.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.